There it is. We are live.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Project Scars podcast.
Oh,
we got a hit there. Finger. Right at the end. We're mid-intro music.
There we go.
Still working on the AV portion of this live podcast just a little bit. That's okay. Nobody live watching us right now, but we know as you start to join, you'll enjoy it. Hello again, and welcome to the Project Scars podcast. My name is Seth Miersma. I am one of your hosts today. Joining me on the show today, as you saw last week, we have Mr. Kyle Hyatt. Say hello, Kyle.
Hello.
And we have Mr. Brett Evans. Hello, Brett.
Hello.
We have got all sorts of used car advice and fun car talk for you today. But before we get into it, I want to let you know that Project Scars is presented by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. And we're also sponsored by the Car ID Drive blog, where you can find amazing stories about cars, owners, incredible builds, unbelievable driving adventures, and get inspired for your next automotive project. Highly recommend it. Got some awesome stuff on the Car ID Drive blog this week. Gentlemen, we have some fun stuff to talk about today, but why don't we kick off like we're creating our routine to be by what we're driving and working on.
Kyle, you've got some neat news to share. Let's hear it.
It's actually not neat news, and that's the problem. So I don't have any press cards or anything this week. So once again, I'm driving around in my Project X5 and my 03911, both of which need considerable work. And so part of what I got going on this week is building up the mental and spiritual fortitude needed to pull the headliner on my 911. There is some sort of a sunroof drain situation that I need to undertake, and a shop wanted to charge me $800 to pull the headliner in that, but like it's not like a cardboard headliner or whatever like in a normal car. It's just like Alcantara with like bows across or whatever, so it should be manageable. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is I need to clean my black hole spider-infested hellscape of a suburban California garage. As you can see, there's so many things going on in here.
And it looks so full of possibility, Kyle.
I know. That's also a very large Southern California garage. That looks great.
Yeah, I mean, listen, again, like 30% of the available space is taken up by Black Widows, I think. But yeah, they're fine. We get along. It's all right. You know, they do their thing. I do my thing. But yeah, so I got to clean that nonsense out in order to get ready to work on the X5, which is going to get completely blown apart for our project car series, project flip series rather. And then
I'm mostly interested in that lovely palette of boxes that you have right there in the middle of this photo.
Yeah. That is a, sort of an indulgence, I guess, that I wanted for a long time. That's a Quick Jack, which, if you're not familiar, is it's made by the Bin Pack people who do like lifts, like car lifts for shops and things like that. But it's essentially like two individual scissor lifts that are connected to a single hydraulic pump, and then it lifts your car up like two or more feet off the ground, and it's like super stable, and it's like you can lift basically anything. Like these ones I got, they have ones that are like 3,500 pound capacity, 5,000 pound capacity, and 7,000 pound. These are the 7,000 pounders in case I embrace chaos and get a Land Rover product in the future.
Yeah. Better safe than sorry, really.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I could lift just about anything. So I got to assemble that. So like the assembly process is allegedly a little bit involved. And I also purchased some stuff to like do little modifications to make them easier to scooch around on the ground, because they currently don't have anything like that. There's just like wheels at the end to like roll them, but like getting them actually under the car is kind of a pain because they're really heavy. Like each side of the lift or whatever is like 85 pounds or something like that.
Oh, wow.
I love, yeah. I love, first of all, it's directionally correct for this podcast and frankly for the whole ecosystem that we're creating here with CarID and CarID Drive, that you are pre-buying modifications for your quick jacks that you haven't even put together yet. You're ready to mod your implements of destruction, as it were, before you've even used them once. That is, your brain is in the right place with it.
Well, you know, as the great Denzel Washington once said, this isn't checkers, this is chess. So, you know, we're thinking a few moves out. I got to get all that stuff assembled and then just generally clean, because everything is everywhere and it's not good. So I can't find anything. So,
yeah, it looks like you're at least on the path to success with it, though, too. Can we rewind just a second to the headliner of the 911, though? Because I'm curious what you mean when you say Alcantara and bows. You mean like ribs? Like it's just
across
ribs, kind of?
Yes, yes, exactly.
So you have to re-stretch it or like sort of stretch
it? No, no, no. It's, kind of it's like, or... they're almost like coat hangers with little hooks on the ends that go into like little rails on the sides of the car. So like it should be pretty easy. From what I've done some, you know, heavy duty YouTube research, as we are all wont to do.
Of course.
And it seems reasonable. Like I also need to pull the headliner on the X5, but I'm sending that to, I think there's some Chechen guys somewhere in Culver City. So, you know, that'll be great. But they're going to charge me like $800 to pull the headliner, all the pillars, and then recover everything. Because that also has sunroof drain issues, because my life is, I deserve it, apparently. That's, you know.
Well, you buy a German car with a sunroof, it comes with the territory.
Sunroofs are a plague. I hate them. Seth, I'm sure, is with me on this one. They eat up headroom, they leak, they're stupid, and for some reason, German cars always, always end up coming with them in the American market, and it's trash.
Yeah, I was going to say the only experience with a headliner I have was when I had briefly inherited an 84 Pontiac Fiero that actually had a true sunroof, meaning before we just unified the terms, the ones that just pop up, as opposed to back in the days when there was a sunroof and a moonroof, which went all the way back. That thing leaked like forever, and the car was covered intermittently. It was my mom's car. She gave it to me. I kind of fixed it and gave it back to her. But that's why I was asking about the ribs and the Alcantara setup. Maybe it's actually easier, because I know with the Fiero, getting the headliner out wasn't actually that much of a chore. The thing was, if you broke the very brittle piece of oddly shaped cardboard that the headliner lived on, you were effed, as it were, right? So so that was kind of the thing. And of course, it was the easiest thing in the world to break, like a little corner or snap in half or anything, because it's 40 years old at this point.
As the general intended.
Yeah.
Easy to break, impossible to replace. The GM story.
It sounds like if any of our scores of live viewers right now are one in the Southern California area and two have a headliner guy, you know, definitely drop a link or a phone number or something in chat, because we can use it. It's also a good excuse for me to remind our live viewers that you guys are welcome to chat with us, ask us questions, interact in whichever way you want. On whatever platform you're watching this out. Right now we are live streaming to YouTube, to Facebook, to Instagram. And if you are catching this after the fact in one of the audio versions of it, you can email us at tips@carid.com. With that out of the way, Brett, what are you driving this week or preparing for? Oh, you're muted.
You're muted. You're still unmuted. Oh, there we go. Beautiful.
My bad. I'm excited for this conversation, because I am driving this little guy. It is a Toyota GR86. Let me get it queued up. But it's not just any GR86. It is the GR86 Trueno, which means it's inspired by the original 86 from the 1980s. So this is this car. I just think it's such a funny, dorky little thing. The black and white graphics on it are so silly. It's got a Trueno badge on the front and on the rear. It's just such a doofy little thing, and I'm like in love. It's so dang fun. And you can kind of tell what Toyota was going with when you look at the original Trueno. This comes from comes from Wikipedia user Tokume Kakari no Aoshima, and you can kind of see where they're going with the vintage badge and the black over white, but it just looks a little silly and dumb rendered in on a modern car, but I still love it. It's just so dang fun.
So yeah. Much like initial D fanboyism built right in. Like I'm ready for people to wrap these around telephone poles left and right as they live out their fantasies.
Oh yeah, for sure. The crazy thing is, it really, like, I know that they, like, made it stickier and more powerful and everything like that for the, you know, when they redesigned it for 2021, but it is still so tail happy. It's so funny. I just was kind of, like, tootling around my neighborhood, and I goosed it, or I popped the clutch a little bit coming away from a stop sign, and it wanted to just immediately step out and slide. So I kind of get the energy for sure.
I had just driven. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I haven't driven, I mean, I've been in a GR86, not, I don't think yet this year, but the, I like that Toyota lets its hair down a little bit for some of its sports cars and is able to do these kind of commemorative editions. I understand, like, it's fan service too, but it's fun. And for a brand that's like, tends to be a little bit more buttoned up, or at least, you know, we think of them that way, to be able to do something like this. I'm not an initial D fan. I kind of miss that wave. Either just by happenstance or because I'm too old, but I obviously recognize the car right away. And I think for people who that car meant a lot to them, they're in the age, you know, they're of an age more than likely to be able to buy a new car right now. So this is kind of fun. And it shows that they have a different kind of heritage, like a cultural heritage and not just an automotive heritage, which is always nice to play on.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of funny because when they do let their hair down, like the cars themselves are great. Like this is a wonderful sports car. It's really fun to drive. The engine finally has torque, and this is my first time driving this generation. So like I'd never been in one yet, and it feels way more interesting and way more fun than the previous one did. But when they do these special editions, they do them in like kind of a really lazy way. Like this isn't even like the pure white. Like the, what was it? I think super white color that the original 86 came in. This is like their pearly, weird metallic white. These are just like tacked on matte black stripes, but I just love it so much. Like, it's just so funny to me that, you know, we're like truly getting back to the era of literal paint and tape special editions where nothing else is going on besides just a few extra stripes and stuff like that. I also love that about the 40th anniversary 4Runner. I thought that was perfect. Like the perfect 4Runner, so terrible in so many ways, but just like, why the hell not add three color stripes to it and call it a day?
Like the sticker package thing coming back is both awesome and sort of lame, but I just imagine like everybody at like Fiat Chrysler USA Stellantis is just, they're like the guy in the yellow suit behind the tree rubbing his hands meme. They're just like, they're ready for it.
Yeah.
They've been waiting for like a decade plus, and they're like, they just got all the stickers printed and they're going to just apply them to everything they make, like Homer Simpson with the makeup shotgun. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be great.
This really is, you're right. This is like challenger territory for me, that they've really hit I mean, obviously like muscle cars have done this, like Mustang Camaro have done this for a long time too. And I know that there are lots of other cars that like have never sort of stopped doing the tape package, but the fact that it's being, I guess, a little bit more common for special editions, I'm not sure what that says about the state of the consumer, the state of the industry, but it is a little bit fun. I will say on this particular GR86 though, that wide, I don't know, what we're looking at now is a black hood stripe that's either too wide to be a stripe or too narrow to be a fully black hood. I kind of feel like it lives in a uncanny valley between those two things, and I would like for it to be. I really just want the whole hood to be black. Right,
like
I guess.
Full on like Fiata Abarth 124 style.
100%,
for sure. Give me the fully black hood. And yeah, and the original obviously didn't have, you know, any hood blackness.
Right. Well, some of them did, and I think that like, so this is the replica from Initial D. So like, this is taken directly from the series. But I like, this is the problem, is like, this is such a rectilinear design. The original 86 is just like straight lines. It's very easy to apply like a black stripe that goes all the way around the car, black hood decals that cover the entire hood, and it doesn't look weird. But like, if you went back to the original and you tried to do a black stripe that goes all the way around the center of this car, it would run into like these weird body lines and scoops and stuff like that just like wouldn't be appropriate. So I think that's kind of the problem with like this retro. It's very silly and very fun. And I think it's why it works really well on stuff like the Challenger Shakedown or like the, you know, like the Rumblebee or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like it works really well on those. Maybe not so much on these because this is a different kind of car than the 86 was. Same kind of energy and same kind of like vibe, but like ultimately it's a different form factor. So
yeah,
but it is a lot of fun. Ultimately, it hasn't ruined the car. Like it's still brilliant to drive.
Maybe the right way to do it, and I agree, like we are absolutely, I don't think any one of us is bagging on GR86, which is, you know, we're going to talk about Miata a little bit too. I think it's one of two cars in a category that are very dear to my heart, amazingly fun on kind of basically any kind of road that's a highway. From a design standpoint though, I've used this example a lot before. It reminds me of those sort of old home improvement shows where they'd be like, you know, like a surprise takeover thing where they'd be like, well, this kid really likes basketball, so we're going to make his whole room the basketball room, right? And it's like painted like a basket, the side of a basket. It's just like over the top on a theme, as opposed to saying like, here's the inspiration. The initial D car is the inspiration for this new GR86. Now give it to one of your many talented designers to take that inspiration and then translate it to something that is actually like kind of fully realized for the existing vehicle, as opposed to this, which again, looks like sort of the a little bit more of a Photoshop version of it come to life or something like that. Sure. That's probably too expensive. So, and again, like I like the fan service, I appreciate it, but it feels like maybe one step further and we'd have something that was truly cool.
Well, and speaking of too expensive, this, it's actually not terrible. It's based on the like fully loaded version. So you get the JBL audio and all that, like the performance package that has the Brembo brakes and the sticky, I think there's sack stampers. So like, it's definitely like fully loaded for sure. It's about $36,000. Like ultimately that's a fair amount of money for the size of the car. But like in the modern landscape of fun to drive sports cars, it's not that much. It's still like a pretty decent value. So, but I think it's like $2,000 more than like the equivalent premium model with the performance parts, but still, you know, if you're really into the Initial D fandom, there's really only one game in town now.
Absolutely.
One thing, going back to like what you were saying about, you know, popping the clutch and having it get a little bit loose on you. I haven't driven this generation, but the previous generation, like I was delivering press cars when I was in college when the FRS and BRZ first came out. So this is like 2012, I think, something like that. And I remember like getting those cars in the fleet and having to like drop them off to journalists at the time. And then like my boss at the fleet company being like, no, listen, seriously, these cars are really like, they're really loose. Like they're so loose. Please be careful. Like, you know, you're not supposed to turn the traction control off anyway, but really don't do it this time. Like, and then like, I was like, yeah, whatever. No big deal. You know, I am like in my mid 20s and I'm professional. I wasn't. And yeah, like the first time I took it like around a like regular city corner that was slightly damp because of Seattle and everything's fully on. And like, I like go to accelerate. I was maybe a little bit aggressive with the accelerator and it just starts to go. And I'm like, whoa, like that. Yeah. That was one of the things where it's like, oh, this car is exactly what it needs to be kind of thing.
I mean,
like,
it didn't help or hurt. Yeah.
Right. Like low speed, like low limits, have fun, play around. You don't need to be going warp 9. Like, and I really appreciate that. And I appreciate that spirit hasn't left the car as it's aged and matured slightly.
Oh, for sure. It's still very, very snappy. And it like doesn't, depending on your perspective, it doesn't help or hurt that the original had 215 series tires all around, like skinny little tires.
Prius performance tires, I believe, if I remember correctly, is the same tires as the Prius performance package, which in and of itself is, wow, who thought that one up? But you know.
Anyway, it's fun though. It's a good time, and I'm really excited. I haven't driven a Miata in a long time, and I think I need to get in one sooner than later so that I can compare and contrast. But that kind of brings us to what you've been tooling around in, Seth.
Yeah. It's a Miata. it's a 24 MX5 Miata Club, and man, it's great. It's Miata is just sort of the most evergreen experience. Oh, I'm so sorry. Excuse me. Yeah, I feel like this, since I've been driving Miatas, and I think that I've been in every generation of them, obviously they've changed, they've evolved, but the overwhelming vibe of the experience that you get has remained exactly the same since the first NA that I've ever piloted, right? Which is just what we were talking about with the 86, frankly, right? Like low power, obviously rear wheel drive, amazingly communicative handling, like you know what's happening. One, just because you're in a convertible, so you like audibly, you can hear a lot more, like you can sort of understand what's going on with the car as long as you don't have the top up, which I never do because I'm far too tall to be in this car comfortably with the top up. But, you know, 181 horsepower or something like that. And it's quicker than ever before, but it never, to me, even the lowest powered Miata has never felt slow because you're just enjoying that experience of being kind of like, you can get really close to the limits of it on a public road without doing anything crazy, right? So I just really, really dig it. I also like, and again, like I'm certainly not breaking new ground here, but this is just the most satisfying convertible top of any car that I've ever driven in my entire career ever, because it's so easy to just grab it and in one easy motion, just like flip it shut or just flip it open. And you're good to go. So if it starts raining when you're out there or, you know, if it stops and you want to open it up, it's ready to go. You don't have to come to a stoplight. You don't have to pull over. You don't have to wait. You don't have to slow down to under 40 miles an hour or whatever the limit of some of those much fancier folding hardtops are. So, you either like a convertible or you don't, but if you do, you like this car, I think is kind of the baseline of the MX-5. And that hasn't changed.
I had an NC for a little while, and I remember one time I was driving on the freeway and like just entered the most like ridiculous, like massive. It was in the Nevada desert, and it was one of those crazy squalls that like rains mud because there's dust in the air already, and then it starts raining. So like just this like deluge of dirty water started pouring in, and I only had like, I slowed down to about 30 miles an hour and I popped the thing and I like muscled it up as I was driving. And that was my first week with the car, and I was like, that alone, I was sold. I was just like, this is the perfect car. This is all anyone needs. Like, it just does everything well. And apparently you can even get through like a Nevada rainstorm without having to pull over, put the top up for 15 seconds, get completely soaked. I loved it. Ah, good car.
So I did the launch for this car. It was just like a really, like a little local Southern California one, the Indy 3 specifically. Mm-hmm. And, what do you think, Seth, of the changes that they made for this one? So like for those of you playing at home, the big changes for the Indy 3 are new calibration for the steering, like a new steering rack, I think, as well. There might be a physical change. And then a new limited slip differential in the back. So when I drove it, like the big thing for me was the diff is great when you're like, zipping around in the canyons or whatever. It makes it super controllable, whatever. The Miata has always been friendly, so that's not a huge change. What did you think of the steering calibration? Like, that's, I'm really curious about that.
I didn't like, so I guess I've driven, probably I've had one Miata loan every year that I've been an automotive journalist, right? So I don't know, like without driving it back to back, I would say that broadly speaking, it does feel like the steering is a little bit number and like I'm getting less feedback through the steering than I remember from generations past. Without having done like the back-to-back of the two, I don't really know that I can say accurately. What was your take on it when you were doing the launch? Did they have the older car there? Or you were a little bit closer to the experience of the previous half-gen?
It had been a while since I'd driven one, so I didn't do it back-to-back. But what they were talking about, one thing that I distinctly remember from all of my other Indy loans is that because it's such a short wheelbase and because it's so direct, the car always felt really nervous on the freeway, like never sketchy, but like you're making a lot of like micro corrections. Right.
Yep.
And so one of their big things that they talked about with this one is they specifically numbed the steering just off center to get rid of that dartiness on the freeway. Mm-hmm. And I actually really liked it because it didn't make the rest of the experience, like once you're off center, it just feels basically the same as it ever has, I would assume. It felt fairly direct and quick and pleasant, and you know, I mean, compared to like an old hydraulic steering car, it's not like wriggling with feedback, but it's good. Sure. For what it is.
Yep.
But yeah, I thought that was a really interesting decision that they made to like make the thing, you know, on paper very slightly worse to make it like way nicer to live with on a day-to-day basis.
This is vindication for every NC owner in the world right now. This is what this is. They're all saying, you all complained about our cars when they were new, but now you want them after you've been dealing with the ND for 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, this is, it, that's really interesting. And where you guys, so again, we said it at the open, but you guys are both, you know, in Southern California, you're both Angelinos for, you know, the sake of this argument. Which means I would imagine a lot more time spent on freeways than for instance for me, right? Like, so I want to go out and try it. I haven't had the car on the highway in my normal day-to-day life, whether I'm driving for life or for pleasure. I don't have to get on a highway ever, right? I can just go from the small downtown that I live near to, you know, like elsewhere in the city, down to a river road, like to the driving roads where I want to go and stuff like that. So I haven't noticed that, but I'm really curious about it. The other thing that I know, that this is already a couple years ago that Mazda launched, I was looking at the specs specifically for the club before the podcast, and I remember getting a call from Mazda PR to ask if I wanted a loan of an MX-5 that had the new, they call it kinematic posture control feature. And it's I think this is also like a little bit in the weeds, but isn't this is essentially like breaking kind of like a tiny amount of brake force applied to the inside wheel so that you're getting like a quicker turn as well, a little bit, like, or maybe this is before, in addition to the diff?
I think this has that as well, if memory serves. I think, yeah. So it's been a couple months, so yeah. But I mean, it makes sense. Obviously, you don't really need to do it with the rear wheel so much now that you have the LSD. But if they're doing it to the front wheel to just trim lines or whatever, and you're not like, it's the Miata's so light anyway, like you're not going to really notice extra brake wear, I would imagine, as you would with, right, like a heavier car. So yeah,
sure. Well, and it's not uses a limited slip differential. Like, it's not like the brake based LSD kind of vibe. It is actually like underdriving underdriving the inside rear wheel. They do it on a lot of their crossovers as well, and I kind of suspect that maybe that's maybe what they adjusted to. I don't know this for sure, but I wonder if that's maybe what they adjusted in the steering to kind of like prevent, like, maybe you don't get as much of that kinematic posture control in like the first degree or two of steering angle, and maybe it only comes into play once you're actually kind of digging in a little bit harder. But
I think it, and again, it's been a while since I had this conversation, but I think it really only happens under like pretty serious cornering loads, like, okay, that they're applying it to sort of like sharpen up the, basically, you know, posture control too, like sharpen up your line, keep the body sort of level as you're going through the corner, right? And I think that in concert with the diff, probably does some interesting things. My point at the time was, like, without having, again, like the old version of the car and the new version of the car to AB, I'm sure it's going to handle wonderfully. It does handle wonderfully, but it's a little bit difficult to say, like, this is discreetly better than the other. My point with the whole thing is that Mazda's working really hard. Like, this is, obviously nobody forgets about MX-5. Nobody forgets about Miata, but Mazda has done a lot of work in this car that feels very stable, again, throughout the generations in terms of the overall experience, to make it sharper, to improve it, to make the power more usable and things like that, in a way that is just like, you know, it's sort of evolutionary in a way that you don't see outside of like 9/11. And I think that's really cool. And I think for people, especially who are, and there's so many of them, who do take this car to a track day or actually like out and out track it, or later in the life, turn it into a kind of a race car, spec Miata, whatever, you can see why it's really meaningful to the sort of primary audience for MX-5. And I just, even though I'm not that guy, right, I would love to have a Miata race car at some point, but I just really appreciate the thought and effort and engineering that goes into making it such a like smile producer, even on a normal Sunday afternoon, right? I think it's cool, admirable, and not often found in new cars these days. So
yeah, I think like that's a good sort of through line with Mazda in general, because it's such a small company relative to other Japanese car companies or any other car company. They don't have all this crazy money for development and like throwing new models with new powertrains. Like, it's so they have to develop stuff sort of in an evolutionary manner, like small changes to improve the product, and which is great for them. But it also helps, I think, and I think this is probably true with the Miata more than a lot of other cars, is when you drive one, you feel that like the people that made it love their job. They love what they're doing. Like they really care about it. And that's why you get these like subtle tweaks to just make it just a little better, just a little bit different. You can tell that the people that are behind those changes are people that like probably have a couple of Miatas at home, and they've driven them before they were at the company, and they love it now. And, you know, like,
and they drive them frequently enough to know that like, oh, this is okay, but like it could be a little better. Like it's not like they do the major model change and leave it on the shelf for the next 6 years. They're out there driving them every day. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. Like again, like my first car was a Mazda. I think most of us enthusiasts have at one point owned a Miata or an RX-7 or a Mazda 3 or whatever. Like they're such an enthusiast driven company in a lot of ways. Like I don't think they get enough credit for that. I mean, that's why even like the quote-unquote boring cars, you know, like the passenger cars, the crossovers or whatever, are always way more fun to drive than they should be or than they need to be, you know, relative to the class. I think that's super cool.
Agreed. Yeah, Mazda stands all around. They just need to, we're always just holding out hope that they sell more cars so that they can hang on and continue to build the ones that we love too.
For sure.
Because they, you're right. They make great crossovers, right? Like they've always made cool sedans and hatchbacks too, but like they do today, like make nice SUVs and crossovers. They're just always oriented. I would say it's like they make a crossover for the person who doesn't really want a crossover. And that's not most people, right? Because
what
we're focusing on is that driving experience. And honestly, you know, in a mid-sized crossover, most people just don't care. So
I think at least
the interiors are getting nice.
Yeah, so. That too. That's a big one. I think I've ended up recommending like people that'll ask for car advice, like friends, family, or whatever. I think I end up recommending Mazdas more often than pretty much anything else with like a, you know, a success rate, just kind of for that reason where it's like, it's attractive. So that's an easy sell. You're not trying to sell them something that's like, you know, look like a transformer fell into a meat grinder. You know, like,
right.
But and it's also, they also just drive really nice and they're not crazy expensive for what they are, you know? And so, yeah, it's pretty cool.
No, in fact, I just recently came across a, cause as you guys know, we talked about this last week. I just sold a car. I've been spending a lot of time shopping for a new used car, a new personal car. And I saw a old, CX-5 manual, like the base CX-5 that they sold with the manual on a Craigslist somewhere in Michigan, and was like, I don't really want an SUV, but I did have very fond memories of driving that car and recommending that car. One, just because it was such a, just an outlier to, you know, for 10 years ago, or whatever, for a new automaker to offer us a compact crossover with a manual transmission.
Yeah, for sure.
Which also kind of leads us into our next topic on the podcast today. I'm saying Facebook Marketplace. You guys will have to forgive me. I'm still very much in the mold of like Craigslist being the place that I go online to shop for used cars, and I prefer it. But I realized, as I'm sure you did, and most of our viewers did a couple of years ago, that Facebook is like taking over this game entirely, right? In terms of digital classifieds for buying and selling vehicles, Facebook has like now kind of owns that space. Especially at the sort of enthusiast end of the marketplace, where I'm not looking for a 3-year-old car that just came off lease that I want to drive day in and day out, right? Like I want something that's fun to drive. It's going to be sort of specific. And I want to buy it from another person. Everything else being equal, I'd rather not go and buy it from a dealership or from a used car lot somewhere. I'd rather buy it from the previous owner. So I find myself in Facebook Marketplace quite a lot these days. And man, the experience is so bad. It's sort of what got us to the topic today. The experience is so bad because, like, I don't know, where should we start? One of you guys can kick off. But what we wanted to talk about today was the fact that this is not ideal. Buying and selling a car is hard enough anyways. You're worried about making a bad decision. You're worried about getting enough money for the vehicle that you have. It feels like sort of a high stress situation if you don't do this all the time, and most people don't. And then on top of that, the way that people behave in these marketplaces, Craigslist can get thrown into this too, but Facebook is really, like I said, the primary mover. It makes it that much worse. So we have, we think, some ideas about how it can be better and how you can be better if you're a buyer or seller on Facebook Marketplace specifically, how to maybe sell your car quicker and also just be more of a cool human being in the process too. Does that cover it?
Yeah, pretty much, I think.
All right, so why don't I just kick off? I had the first item on the list here because this is one that just happens all the time. We were chatting about this before we went live, right? My first sort of rule, my first piece of advice is don't ask about a car that you don't actually want to buy, right? No, I mean, I suppose it's okay if you are like, I might be interested in this car if I know that it hasn't had any major modifications performed to it, or there isn't, we'll get to this later, but there isn't a very detailed description. So I need to like check off some really basic stuff about the car that I want to buy. Like, does it have a particular option that I've been looking for that's not listed and not easy to find in the photos, right? So I get that. There are some sort of barriers for entry, but what I'm seeing all the time, and again, just sold a Mercedes, so I went through this, is cars listed for sale. 20 people DM me saying, I would like to see this car, or would you take X amount of money for this car? Or mostly it's just the canned, is this car available? Because that's the easiest thing to do. You just hit the button. That's the prompt that Facebook has already ready to go. So I imagine some of those are accidental. And then the follow-up for me is always, like, I don't do the thing where I'm like, I need you to get over a certain bar before I will answer you. I just say yes. I just answer everybody. And 9 times out of 10, people don't ever respond back, right? So it's a waste of their time. It's a waste of my time. And it doesn't accomplish anything. Like, you're talking about this, I don't feel like I'm being scammed. And yet somehow it seems like it must be a scam that so many people are just directly saying, like, is your car available? Or I would like to offer you money for it, and then just never writing back. You guys have obviously seen this before. Do you have any more insight as to why this would be happening?
I think it's just that ease of hitting that button, hitting that, is this still available? I think there's probably just some people who lack critical thinking skills and like their little lizard brain goes, oh, that's a neat looking car. I don't have $10,000, but it has piqued my interest for half a second. I'm going to hit that button and see what's what, you know, like, I think that that's kind of just like part of it is just this, I don't know. It's like window shopping in a much more intrusive and aggressive way, in my opinion, I think.
Hostile window shopping.
I mean, like, I think about, like, I'll go to a dealership and walk around a dealership and try door handles and stuff like that and have absolutely no interest in buying any one of those vehicles. And I feel like this is just the digital equivalent of that, of just, I don't know what it is. I don't know. I mean, I have no thoughts.
I think people just turn into sociopaths on the internet. And so, like, there's no there's no perceived consequence to their actions. And yeah, like Brett said, like, the lizard brain's like, ooh, a thing. I want to, like, click the thing so that my brain thinks I bought it for, like, you know, a nanosecond, and therefore improve the state of, you know, my sad life and the late stage capitalism or something. Like, it's just, yeah, like this little tiny adrenaline hit that people get, which I guess, you know, I get, it's like the same thing of like bidding on an eBay listing. You don't actually want, but just to, like,
or adding stuff to your cart and then letting it sit for 3 weeks and then emptying your cart. Finally, you know, like, yeah, it's just, yeah, this like a little dopamine hit of like the potential and excitement and possibility of doing it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, like, we maybe you guys haven't, but I've definitely been guilty of inquiring about a car that I was interested in, but I kind of thought, I'm sort of looking for something else, but if this were to go right, like, I would go take a look at it and I would be serious about it, right? Like, I don't actually mind. There's that whole, like, no tire kickers thing too, right? If somebody wants to take a look at the car, I have a very hard time making up my mind about buying a new car just by looking at pictures online and knowing what the price is, right? I definitely won't negotiate seriously over like you know even a text or a phone call if I'm not looking at the car, because I want to see it, right? I want to experience in real life. So I understand that people also need to take that. I'd probably go to the other extreme. When I was selling years ago, I had a 986 Boxster and I was selling it, and there were a couple people who came out who really did. Like, there was one guy who rode with me who like towards the like halfway through the test drive was just like, someday I really hope that I can afford a car like this. And I said, you know that you're in the midst of what could be a sale, like right now. We are in a commercial proposition today, but he just didn't have the money to afford it. So and there were other people who came out who just wanted to like get a ride or drive around in the car, which is crazy because an old Boxster is wonderful, but it's not like a Lamborghini or something. Like, it's not a rare experience. You can find one.
But if you're like a civilian that dailies a 30-year-old Camry, like anything with a Porsche badge is like, oh my God, let me get like that, that's the life I need to live.
That's fair. And my problem is like, I have so few people. We obviously do this for a living and we travel to drive cars and stuff like that, but nobody in my real life cares about cars. So actually, like, if every couple of years somebody shows up and they just want to talk to me about a car that I like and go for a ride in it, I'm like, oh, that's actually like a pleasant social outing, as long as you're not a psychopath. But admittedly, maybe I'm the weirdo in that situation. So in any event, yeah, rule number one is just don't ask about a car that you don't want to buy unless you have a real question about it, right? I think that's probably sound advice. What's next on our list?
I think the incredible lack of decent photography in car ads is shocking. I mean, like, okay, so I'm going to pull up an example really quick. This is like peak infuriation to me. And we're not going to judge the car. We're not going to like really judge the seller too hard, but this person uploaded a screenshot of their cell phone gallery of a car. They found the photo in their cell phone gallery and took a screenshot and uploaded that image instead. And this shows just like a clear lack of like critical thinking skills, where you know how to upload a photo, clearly. You know how to find a photo in your gallery, clearly. And you just don't connect those two dots. So this drives me crazy. Seth has another really great option. Another really great example of just outlandish photography skills.
So I'm hunting GTIs right now, and I somehow ended up on the Wichita, Kansas Facebook Marketplace. And we can go back. We'll talk about this one, but even if you just scroll through like all of them, you just see like a number of examples. But this guy, so for those of you who are listening and not watching, the lead photo is a sideways rear shot of the car. So it's a portrait oriented shot of the car on the ground. So it appears to be like sort of stuck to a wall in this case, but it's sideways. That's their best effort. That's their lead photo. Then I think it's neat. Facebook now gives you the option to upload a video. You can use sort of video as your cover, do a walk around or something. This person, instead of doing that, has their phone in their hand while they're driving the car. We don't have the sound on, and we probably shouldn't, because we'll get some sort of copyright strike, because they're listening to music in the car. It's a rainy day and you're just seeing the driver's side view mirror as they drive down a wet road listening to local radio. So I don't know, like, I guess he kind of runs the engine once. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be gathering from that data point, but it's not great. And again, anybody who's done this, like looking for cars, like if you just scroll through the feed, you can see, here's an interior shot of a door handle. Here's a photo of, you know, like a decent photo of a wheel or something like that. But we're not selling a wheel, we're selling a whole car. So even if your smartphone is 10 years old, frankly, at this point, it is so easy to just like step back, get the car fully in frame, roughly a front angle of the car is great, take a picture, take two more of the outside, a couple of the interior, and then upload it, and you're done, right? Like, you don't have to be an amazing photographer to do it. You just kind of have to know how to like point the lens of your phone camera in the right direction and push the button. So this baffles me. For sure.
I like this this pressure washing Jetta with a sweet Dutch angle going on there. Like, pretty good. Like, how much art can you stand, really? We should, as part of the drive blog, Car ID Drive, we should do a guide for people. Like, these are the like 9 photos you need to take of your car, and here's how to take them. Like, front 3/4, rear 3/4, side, front, back. Like, view from like getting in the driver's door, view of the backs, like really basic stuff, and then provide examples. Like, I feel like that's just something people need. Like, they just need the help.
Well, and like, it's the thing is, they're already taking the photo, they're already out by the car, they've already like gotten up, moved out to the driveway. It's just not that much harder to then expend, you know, 2% more energy to just frame the shot better. Like, it's if you're already going through the process, you've already sunk the cost of getting off the couch, you might as well just kind of like spend a little bit more and just get it right the first time. So
I'm not even asking for high level stuff. I'm not saying don't shoot the car on grass. I'm not saying, you know, move the car, not yourself. We're not aiming for, you know, for peak stuff here. We just want the basics. And ultimately, it'll help you sell your car faster, probably for more money.
The differentiator that I like to point out too is, if you go to the sort of high zoot version of these marketplaces, which are Bring a Trailer and Cars and Bids, right? The one thing that they've done to separate themselves, and you could say the same of you know, like Haggerty is another good example, right? Where they do this, where they vet them a little bit more. Hemmings. They do good photography of the cars. They require good photography of the cars. And it doesn't have to be like beautiful quality, although in some cases you do get really amazing quality from those, like professional quality. They just say, like, have these shots, have hundreds of them and not just 10 of them, so that people can say everything. And I think that you know, like, there's a lot more that goes into it than this, but I think that you can go and see that the results on platforms like that are that cars sell for a lot more money too.
And they're not even always flawless cars. There was a Buick Roadmaster Estate that I just stupid bid thing where, you know, you're probably not going to win it, but you bid on it anyway to get a little hit of dopamine. I absolutely did that on this Roadmaster Estate, and it sold for a good amount of money, and it had all kinds of flaws all over it. Like, it had dings and little spots of rust, and the interior was kind of falling apart, and he had photos of everything, all of that. So it's not even like, by reducing the amount of photography that you're doing, you're hiding flaws and trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes. You give everyone all of the information they need to make an informed purchase, especially using one of these online marketplaces, and you're going to get more money. Like, whatever, even if you hire someone to wash the thing really well, and maybe hire a friend who knows how to take a photo to do that photography, you're going to get that $300 investment is going to get paid back just by nature of having really high quality, really informed stuff.
So I just sent a link to you guys in the chat, and this is a really good example. So a couple of years ago, I had a pickup truck that I sold for my first ever online auction experience, right? And it's a cool truck, like, it's weird and rare and stuff. But I ended up like paying a friend of mine, a professional photographer, to shoot like professional photos of this truck. And when once it sold. Well, these ones are mine because they're terrible, but those ones aren't mine. Those are the ones I paid for. I ended up like talking to the buyer after the auction, and he said like probably 60% of the reason he bid on it were like the photos. Like, it's like, it just looked cool. Like, and especially like when you're selling like an enthusiast car, not that this, I mean, this definitely was, because it was like a 6-speed manual V10 two-wheel drive F-250 with like 55,000 miles on it. But if you're selling like a Miata or something, like a friend of ours is selling a Miata right now, you're not just selling a car, you're kind of selling a dream a little bit, or like a little bit of a lifestyle, with specifically with the auctions, because like, you don't go on a car auction if you're trying to just buy, you know, your next daily driver. Usually you're on there looking for something cool, like something that you want, like, to fulfill a need. And yeah, like, just like, it's one of the things, it's like good photos. I ended up doubling my money on this truck. Wow. Yeah, it went for like almost 15 grand.
This is a prime example because it's clearly been used. It's got a few little chips and dings here and there. You've given the buyer everything that they need, but you've done it in like a really thorough and also concise way. They're getting all the information they need. You two could have engaged in 15,000 messages on Facebook Messenger where you describe every little problem, or you could just give them a full photo set and you've done all of the work that they need to do to make an informed decision and feel comfortable spending 15 grand on that truck instead of just wondering if maybe they should only up their bid to 10 and then drop out.
Totally. And like the person that bought it never came to see the car. They're from the Bay Area or whatever. So they never physically saw it. They bought it strictly from the auction site and then flew down and drove it back. And weirdly, they're a friend of fellow journalist Jason Camisa. And this truck ended up on his social media like a month ago. And I was like, what are you doing? You can't drive this. This isn't for you. But good photos, like photos taken with intent. And not just like, oh, I have to do this. Really makes a big difference for buyers.
I think the intent is really important there. And it goes into one of our next tips, right? Like, so what, one of the things that you do, certainly when you hire somebody, right, you're right. When you pay somebody to detail the car, when you spend money or your own time and effort to take great photos of the car, you're also showing everybody that you're sort of a responsible person who cares about this vehicle enough to, you know, it's self-interested at this point because you're trying to do it to get a lot of money out of it. But you're also not just so lazy that you're just leaning over to take a photo of the car through your living room window, right? And this also holds true. I don't know who put this one down. You can take it from here, but like in the description, right? Like, now, we are all writers, editors by trade. So I know that some of this maybe comes easier for us than it does for some people out there who are watching or listening, right? Totally understand that. And I don't expect, although it's wonderful when you find it, there's so many times when I found an incredibly well-written description for a car on some sort of platform, including Facebook. It's much rarer on Facebook, but where they've done not only a great job of describing everything I want to know about the car, but they've done it in an entertaining way. I always think like this is somebody who should be writing about cars if they're not for a living because they're really good at it. But you don't have to do that. It doesn't have to be a story. It doesn't have to be funny. It doesn't have to be great prose. What it has to be is as exhaustive as you're willing to make it in describing the condition of the car. And critically, like telling me the things that are going to make me want to buy the car, right? Like, forget about even the flaws. Forget about even being honest and trustworthy. Like, does it come from an interesting year? Does it have any modifications that people might care about or find interesting? Like, does it have service records? Does it have like any information, frankly, that you give that are providing more data points? Every single time you do that, every sentence you write makes me trust you as a seller a little bit more in the description, right? We'll pause for a second because we've got Natalia. Natalia, thank you for writing. Apparently is in this right now. She's writing us from Facebook and saying that she is selling a 72 Nova SS and she's been trying to sell it for the past 3 years. So Natalia, you feel our pain.
What's the holdup here? Is it that you can't find the right buyer or I'd be curious to know if she's just getting all these like really low quality interest people who are just hitting, is this still available? Is this still available? Is it still available for the last 3 years? Or is this a situation where you've got it listed for $50,000 more than it's actually worth so that you can claim that you're trying to sell it while still actually keeping it for yourself and being happy about that?
Yeah. Like, is it you or is it the car kind of thing?
So like she says low quality interested people, and that's totally fair. That's, you know, that's a niche and that's kind of a niche product too. You're not really going to find a whole lot of people who are going to default to Facebook or Craigslist to find any muscle car kind of product.
Sure.
So,
well, and also you're probably also dealing with a lot of boomers. Let's be honest. A lot of tire kickers, a lot of, oh, I had one of these in high school kind of folks, you know, and that's fine. Like those people are allowed to buy cars, I guess, but like, but they can be really frustrating to deal with, right? Like if they're not familiar with sort of the shape of discourse on the internet in 2024, you know, like they're operating, it's like every word is capitalized in their response kind of a situation. Like,
right.
You know,
Well, we also have a, she's followed up, Natalia's followed up and said, I lost the title, which is not a big deal, and I've dropped the price on it. I'm going to go ahead and say a lost title is a big red flag for me as a buyer, especially since if you own the vehicle, if this is a legit sale and you own the vehicle and it's all free and clear in your name, it's really easy to go get a duplicate title. So
yeah,
that's going to be like there. That's maybe going to be another buying tip for me, is that if the solution that you need, if the problem that you have that you need to solve in order to sell the vehicle is $100 or less, do it. Like if it just needs a new battery and then it'll start and run fine, go buy a new battery and put it in it. If you've lost the title, go down to the DMV and make an appointment and go spend some time at the DMV. So good deal. She says that she's done that. She's applied for the duplicate title. I think you're going to have a little bit easier of a time selling it when you've got the title in your hand. It can prove that this is your car. So yeah, anytime there's a quick solution that makes a buyer be able to drive it or hear it run or something like that, just do it, because people are going to be a lot more willing to spend money if they can actually, like, if they know that there's not some hidden snag that they can't unearth because the battery doesn't work or something like that.
You know what? Actually, too, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, like, Natalia, you should email us your listing at tips@carad.com. And you know what? We are three quasi-professional men in the industry. We'll check it out. We'll see. Like, we'll see if we can kind of give you a direction to go, you know, with the listing. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's first of all, that sounds fun to me. The person who used to go, like, in college, go and, like, spell check Craigslist ads, you know, copy edit Craigslist ads. Let's send it to us, and we'll see if we can help you out.
It's email is tips@carid.com, carid.com. So yeah, drop us a link to your listing. If there's a glaring error, we'll respond. Maybe you are just getting low quality people, and maybe it's time to check out Hemmings or Cars and Bids or something like that. Probably some easy solutions there. Or you can just keep it, because that sounds like a really bitchin' piece of machinery, and you should maybe just keep it forever and maybe be buried in it, because it sounds really sick.
72 Nova SS is pretty hot.
Say, what year was the Nova in that movie Drive, the Ryan Gosling one? I think his was later.
Great question.
76 or something. That thing is mean as hell.
Yeah, they're super cool. I do think that we are. I mean, muscle cars have never really fallen out of favor, like completely, because the boomer generation still has lots of money and still is investing in them. But I do hope that there's like the bubble shrinks a little bit at some point, maybe the next 20 years. So some of those cars that I'm maybe old enough to appreciate, but not spend six figures on, come back down to earth a little bit, because they are super fun.
Oh yeah, I think about getting a 63.5 Falcon all the time, like specifically that, because it's like it's still kind of the round, like the last of the round years, the 289. There's a guy that would bring one of those to the original Cars and Coffee here in Irvine like a billion years ago, and full on like Holman Moody like vintage. He built the car to the like the 1962 SCCA rule book, so it's like legal to compete in 1962. It's the sickest thing ever, and I'm like, man, I could do that. I could daily drive that. It'd be great, because I'm an idiot.
I kind of think some of those cars are like, I've seen Tri-5 Chevys, that used to be a $120,000 car in like absolutely mint condition, and they're kind of softening up a little bit, like maybe not always six figures, you know. It used to be like a guaranteed blue chip investment, because I would love to do like a 56 or 57 Nomad as like a dad wagon. Would be so fun for me. And they've always been 150,000 to $200,000 cars, and I think they're softening up a little bit. You know, you maybe hope that one of these cool boomer muscle cars are gonna start coming down into the realm of reality for most of us sometime soon.
Are you ready to embrace your Wingadinga era, Brett?
Heck yeah, man. Absolutely. You grow
the Dennis Gage mustache out.
Oh, I just want to be Jill Taylor from Home Improvement. I want to be the cool mom driving around in the Chevy Nova. That's what I want.
Oh yeah.
Real bad.
They had a Nomad too, right? Like the two-door wagon.
Nomad, that's what I meant. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, they had a Nomad. Yeah.
It's been so long since I just remember the episode where Mark went goth, and that's like, you know, that's not it. But
Oh my God, I can't wait for this podcast to evolve to a level of maturity where we can just do a home improvement, the cars of home improvement deep dive. Frankly, I think the internet has been waiting for
I engaged in that exact activity probably 6 months ago when I noticed that home improvement episodes were on Disney Plus. I went to the Internet Movie Car Database and found all of the episodes wherein there were like prominently featured cars, and I just watched every single car related episode. It was a great, great use of a Tuesday evening.
What a terrible show.
I mean, like, let's call the character Wilson, where you only ever see half of his face, brilliant. Like, that was like, you know, that's who I aspire to be as I, like, you know, plow headlong into middle age. It's just be like, I'd be a less helpful Wilson. That's what I'm going.
We've gone off the rails already, so I'm just going to keep us going. I remember in the last episode of Home Improvement, so like they finished the episode and then they did like a 20-minute like after the episode like special with all the actors coming on and like standing around and talking. And the character of Wilson came out with his hands like this, and then he removed his hands, and it like blew my mind as a 9-year-old person to learn that person actually had a face beneath. Like behind the fence, it was so.
It's like
crazy.
Seeing Cobra Commander.
Really,
that's like if they had showed somebody shooting Tony Soprano. Like it just ruins it. Like nobody needs that. Let's have a little mystery in our lives.
Was really. I would have loved to have just seen him on like that. You know that like interview couch, just holding like a picket fence right in front of his face. Like a little. That would have been great. But no, it was really bizarre.
He's like the Orville Peck of mid-90s primetime sitcoms. Like
he's a straight neighborly Orville Peck.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we all really want in our lives.
Earl Hindman, if you're still alive, come on the show.
Truly.
No, I'm sorry. He is deceased. He passed away more than 20 years ago now.
Rest in power, big dog.
We should try and get Richard Karn on the show. I would love to talk with him for a little while.
Oh yeah, I'm a carnivore for sure, 100%.
No, that's not a turn. That's not a term.
I hope it's not. I really hope it's not. I regret bringing it into the world if it wasn't.
It's a hashtag on Instagram now, and it's one you're gonna love.
Yeah. Let's help some people sell some cars. What do you think?
Let's put that on the list. Yeah. All right. So what else? So we talked about descriptions. We talked about photos. We talked about only inquiring about something you want to buy. How about negotiating, right? We've got that on the list too. What's your stance on negotiating both in virtually, like when you're on the platform, when you're on Facebook, and elsewhere? Where do you guys stand?
Let me chime in with this one. Like there's almost nothing that pees in my Wheaties, figuratively speaking, more than somebody messaging and just being like, what's the lowest you'll take? Like
right, bottom line.
Like get bent, dude. Like, what do you mean that was the lowest I'll take? I'm not going to tell you that information. What do you think this is? Like,
I don't mind having that conversation without being in person or without seeing the vehicle in person first, because I don't really love, like, I've been in a situation where I'm like, I have $3,500 to spend. This person is asking five. I know it's probably worth somewhere in between, but I literally only have $3,500. And if I feel like if I were dealing with a buyer, I would want to know that going in, is be like, listen, you'd be wasting both of our time. I'm not going to take $3,500 for it. So I'm okay with that idea after you've actually established some kind of dialogue.
That's fine. Yeah. But like being like right off the jump, like,
no, absolutely not.
No.
GTFO. We're not interested.
Yeah. Or people that are like really low ball offers. Like I'm selling a car for $15,000. Like you take eight for it. Like, I don't know. Like, let me think. How about never? And how about also you're being blocked? Like,
yeah.
By the way, I'm not. I'm like the saltiest person ever when trying to deal with this stuff. But I also try to be really helpful and provide a lot of information when I sell a car too. So
that's you know. It. Like the context of this matters, right? Like, are you negotiating on a fact that you don't know about because you haven't seen the car, right? Are you the thing that gets me about either the bottom line question or sending kind of low ball offer? Is it's different if you can tell the listing has been up for 67 days, right? Or for our friend Natalia who's been trying to sell the car, if the listing is 3 years old, I know that I probably have a little bit more wiggle room to negotiate because you're still trying to sell the car and it's been a long time, right? Mm-hmm. If it's literally the listing has been up for 5 minutes and the first question I get is, will you take half of your asking price for the car? My answer is always going to be, right now I'm asking for fill in the asking price here, right? Like, I just always stick to my guns on that, even if I do have some flexibility in the price, because dude, it just went up and I have two messages in the last 30 seconds for right. somebody asking me about a price. The other thing is, I just went through this with the Mercedes, right? So I sold the Mercedes for 10 grand. Everybody wanted to pay me 8 grand for the first, you know, I think it was up for like a month or something. For the first 2 weeks, I had somebody show up with a truck and a trailer ready to go with cash in an envelope, right? And I just knew that I didn't want to take it. I also knew I had a couple of other offers of people who I at least spoke to on the phone saying like that was kind of where they were at with the car. That's fine. So at that point, I did reach a level where I was like, a lot of people think that they're going to be able to get this for $8,000, which is fine. I'm not willing to sell it. I was at that point with some other potential buyers saying like, if you do want to come out and see the car, that's great. Just know that I've already turned down $8,000 several times.
Right.
I'm not doing that to be a hard negotiator. I'm doing it because I really don't want them to waste their time and to waste my time in showing the car if that's what they think it's worth. Right.
Yeah. Like I think that's really healthy. Like that, if somebody did that for me, like buying a car, I'd be like, okay, absolutely. I respect that. Like I can't spend that much yeah, that's fine. Like that's kind of within, you know, that's in the window of what I'm looking for, you know, to spend on something. Like, you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think that also like sort of dovetails into one of my other big pet peeves, which is, if the listing does not mention trades, do not offer me to trade something for my car. Like, no, I don't want your Astrovan, like for my 1970 Mercedes or whatever. Like, that's not going to do it. I specifically, usually in the listing, if I write, I'll specifically say like, no trades. I do not want trades. Like, and there's always that like people just don't read the fine print. That's not even fine, because I usually put it in all caps because I'm miserable. yeah, that's so annoying. Like, just follow instructions. Now I'm not going to sell you the car out of spite. Like,
right. I made a rule and you didn't follow it. No, right. So again, I always loved the idea of trades. I mean, I wouldn't, if in years past when I've been selling a car that's like my primary daily driver, because I needed to buy another primary daily driver and I couldn't screw around with it, no problem. Usually over the last decade or so, it's been like a second or third car, whatever, where you just kind of like keep the money rolling into something else that's fun to drive, right? And there, I'm always curious what people would be willing to trade and give up for it. Now, I think I even wrote this in the last listing for the Mercedes. I'm open to the idea of it. I've literally never seen it work. I have zero example in my life and like my friend group and family of trading cars working. But I accept that like it probably has in the history of humankind. Like, I think people have probably pulled it off before. I just think it's really hard to do.
I did it once.
Yeah.
And it worked okay. But it was a weird trade. So
I also tried to trade the Boxster that I was talking about earlier for a Rolex Submariner at one point, which was an interesting experience. It would have been a good deal for me from a financial perspective, but it was also the biggest hit I've ever had on Reddit by posting that on both watch forums and on it's not Our Cars, but like a car sales forum too. Mm-hmm. It went bananas. I was not able to get a Rolex out of it. So
I hate that for you.
I know. I was sad. I was sad. I had one offer, but I had to like be willing to ship the car sight on without seeing the watch to like Arizona or something, which felt like, again, how do we make this work in an equitable way?
Right. Yeah. No, that's so, like,
there was a really great post that went viral not long ago. It's not long ago. It was probably like 7 years ago, but it was a viral post that I remember vividly about a guy who traded a clicky pen for a Porsche Boxster over a series like several dozen trades, where he just eventually got himself up to like 1997 first model year 986 Boxster from a clicky pen without spending one dime. And I would love to have that level of talent and that level of patience to do that. I just be like, I'm just gonna buy one. This is too much work.
The tolerance for malarkey that you'd have to have to do that. It's just unbelievable.
The malarkey factor is not there for me, quite frankly.
Yeah, same. There was another one of those where like somebody was like, I'm starting with a paperclip and I'm going to get a house. And it's like, good for you. Like, also, I kind of hope you get hit by a meteor. Like, you know.
Listen, times are tough. Millennials got to take whatever action they can to get a house these days. So
don't I know it? Don't I know it?
Well, we've got, so one, I just want to say again, I just want to say thank you to Natalia, who I feel like has been our fourth podcaster today. Natalia, you've been wonderful. Lots of comments here. We have your email. We have your listing. I don't think it's fair to do it live, to go over it live on air, but we will take a look at it. And I promise that next week we'll come back and we'll talk about what improvements we might recommend for Natalia's listing. Is there anything else we need to know about buying and selling cars, guys, before we sign off? We've been yammering on here for a while.
This is my last. This one relates to sellers, not to buyers, regarding tolerance for malarkey. When I was shopping for that NC Miata several years ago, I emailed a guy who was selling a 99 Miata. I said, hey, how many miles does it have on it? Wasn't listed in the ad. How many miles does it have on it? 140,000 miles. Okay, cool. When was the last oil change and how long have you had it? How many miles have you had? I was fishing for like, how many records do you have? What do you know about this car? So I said, all I said was, cool, 140,000 miles. How long have you had it and when was this last oil change? And his response was, sorry, you asked too many questions. This car isn't for you. And I was like, like, I wanted to engage in the ancient Scottish martial art of fuck off, and it was really annoying to me. Like, I can't even tell you.
I can't even begin to know how to deal with questions about my car that I'm selling. Like,
I know. Well, the best part was, so I posted it. I posted a screenshot of the email with his name blocked off. His name is an email, and his email blocked off. And my brother private texted me and said, what's his email? Or like, what, like, send me a listing of the car. And I sent him a listing and he catfished the guy for like 2 days, pretending to be like an 18-year-old girl who was brand new to cars and like really wanted to like, was like, oh my gosh, this would be my first car. Like, if I need help, like, will you help me like work on it sometimes? Like fully like catfishing this guy. And then he like got, like, they got to the part where it was like, do you have any more questions about the car? And when can you come look at it? And then he just like sent a like, multiple pages long copy paste from like some car advice website of what you should look for when you're buying a used car. And it was like, have the generator points been restored recently? Is the 6-volt system up to date? Like, it was like the most absolute malarkey BS, but it was like a 2-day long DM process that he engaged in with this person. So that's what you can look forward to if you're not willing to talk about your cars. Very simply to interested parties.
Yeah. The last one that I have, and this is like the biggest one for me, is if you're a buyer and you want to come and check out my car, show up. Show up when you say you're going to show up. Or conversely, if you can't, if something happens, if something changes, whatever, tell me. Send a Facebook message or a text or a call, an email, carrier pigeon,
before
whatever.
The specified time as well. Not like 20 minutes after.
Right. Exactly. And then also like as if you're a seller, if I'm coming to look at your car to potentially buy it, like also just be there when you say you're going to be there. And if the car, like, don't let somebody come and see the car if we've agreed on a time for me to come and see the car, unless you've, like, tell me about it, right? Like, if I need to try and come earlier, then I will. But don't be like, oh yeah, a guy wanted to come like 10 minutes from now, when I show up and be like, you know, so the car's sold, you know, whatever. Like, that kind of stuff is, it's just rude. Don't do that to people, you know? Just be considerate.
Generally speaking, just be, just treat people how you would treat them if you met them in the supermarket online. and then when you're following up.
There you go.
It's pretty easy. It's pretty easy. Turns out, to some, that it's easy to be a real human being on Facebook Marketplace, even, and on Craigslist. It's not that, I mean, it's never going to be easy to sell a car or to buy a car because there are lots of hoops that we have to jump through, but we can make it all easier for ourselves and for each other if we just follow these however many steps that we've outlined here. So, service rendered to the community of auto enthusiasts. I feel pretty good about that. What about you guys?
Heck yeah.
You're welcome.
We're doing the Lord's work here. we have some more questions from Natalia. I'm going to write these down and make sure that we answer them. We are well past our sell by date, I think. So I'm going to write some of these down and we'll answer them both via maybe via that tips email that you sent us, Natalia. And then no, you're great. Thank you for don't apologize for trying to for interrupt. You're doing amazing. Thank you for commenting. But yeah, we'll write down these questions. We'll get some answers for you, and then we'll go look at your listing and see if we can maybe come up with some good tips. Anyone else who has a challenging listing that they need to help sell a car, send us an email, tips@carid.com. We'd be happy to render this service.
Try and go through them maybe next week. Some of like the bigger ones, the better ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just in general, if for listeners after the fact, if you haven't joined us live, if you're watching this video on YouTube, or if you're catching us on a streaming service, you have questions about car listings or things that you want to share, you can always email us there, hit us in the DMs, hit us in the comments. We'd love to talk about that after the fact. We will be back next week, Wednesday, I believe. No holidays or travel that I know of interrupting us. You guys, we're going to be going live every Wednesday at 1 o'clock Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific time. So you can find
10 a.m. Pacific.
10 a.m. Pacific time. It's difficult to do that math in my head every time. I know it's a minus three. You think I 46 years old? You think I can manage it?
Time is a flat circle. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter.
Ultimately meaningless.
10 a.m. 1 p.m. for the live show, or catch us in a recorded version any other time. We've been really happy to chat with you today, and we hope you see you again next week.
Yeah.
Later, all.
Keep all your fingers and toes tomorrow. Let's not, stay safe, guys.
That's right. 4th of July. Everybody party responsibly, firework responsibly, and if you're drinking, don't drive, right?
No, that's a good idea. Calls. Don't do that.
Good advice, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. Grown up. All right. Later on.
Con Dios.
Next week.